All right, good evening. Welcome to Tzion from the Baltimore Hebrew Institute and hosted by Beth El, the Hebrew Institute at Towson University. My name is Neil Rubin, and this is a really interesting course because it's a hybrid course. It's really kind of, I explain it to people as an uber adult ed course. So I think it's for people who don't mind doing a little reading and really want to have a good time and really dig into a topic. And we're going to really dig into the topic, and I've had lots of fun. I've been digging in since this summer in terms of preparing for this course, since the beginning of the summer. So I'm pretty excited about it. And if we get through everything that I have planned for us, it'll be somewhat of a minor miracle. But let's get started. What I'd like to do first is, just so we can all get to know each other a little bit, is tell a little bit about ourselves, and then tell me what you'd like to get out of this course or what you're hoping that we're going to cover. And then we're going to go through the syllabus, and then we're just going to jump right in. So,
my name is Mitch Gold. I have a keen interest in Israel. Zionism is the foundation of Israel. I want to gain a better understanding of it.
Okay, terrific. Thanks, Mitch.
I'm Robert Keene. I was a past president here at Bethel. Just the program was that I went to yeshiva through high school.
Terrific.
I'm Marshall Bedeen. Love history. One of my kids made Aliyah.
Are you related to David Bedeen, the investigative journalist in Israel?
No.
No? Okay.
Beverly Max, mother of Jill and Aaron Max. About these two.
details.
Cindy and Rob.
She disowns us right on the beginning.
I've been a Zionist since childhood. My parents were very involved in Zionism. I would like to haven't studied anything about it for many years and would like to.
Terrific.
David Beekman, I've been Jewish since birth.
Okay, good enough. Thank you, David. Yeah.
My name is Joanna Goodwin Friedman, and I am the president of a foundation called the Middle East Peace Dialogue Network that has been working in Israel since the early 1980s. And I wanted to expand my base of knowledge regarding the whole historical evolution of Zionism.
Good, terrific.
And my name is Mark Friedman, and I study with my wife.
Smart man. Yeah, Aaron?
Aaron Max. I too live with my brother, my sister-in-law, my mother. I've actually never taken a course.
Great. It's always a good time to start. Terrific. Jill?
Jill Max. I'm also the director of Baltimore Hebrew. I've spoken with most of you or emailed with most of you. And I'm really excited about this class because it was by a colleague of mine in Boston who created the MEA program, which some of you are first PhD at Towson teaching class. So it kind of, and I haven't taken a class on Israel, and I'm really very excited about it.
All right, so we're all basically here for the same reason. We have a desire to learn and to focus in on Zionism in Israel. And one of the interesting things about what we're going to be doing is, unlike what most people talk about today when they talk about Israel, is we're going to be talking about the foundational understandings of Zionism and nationalism and what it meant to the Jewish people, starting from the biblical era, but we're stopping in 1948. So yes, we're going to do Echad HaAm, the cultural Zionist, and Ben-Gurion, and Jewish socialism, and, you know, a little bit of Jewish history along the way, everything from Kabbalists in Sfad to, you know, Shabtai Tzvi we're going to be mentioning. We're really going to be tracing a lot of that, and we're going to stop in 1948, just as Israel becomes a state. So we're not doing the peace process. We're not doing, we actually will do a little bit of Menachem Begin because of his role in the 1940s. We're not doing Yitzhak Rabin. We're not doing Shimon Peres. We're not doing Benjamin Netanyahu. So when you tell people that you're taking a course about Israel, it's more appropriate to say, I'm taking a course about the prehistory of Israel. So I just want to be very clear in that. However, at the same time, because of my background and the interests of many of us, if in the beginning of each class, and we'll see how it goes, there's something that you want to talk about in current events, Dr. Friedman, my mentor, always took 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning of every class, and he spoke about current events in terms of what was going on in Israel and the Middle East. So if you feel that there's something pressing that you want us to address, we can certainly do that. And, you know, at this stage, I, like you, are basically finding out things by surfing the Internet, reading newspapers, listening to interviews, but I can hopefully give you some perspective on that. So that's what we are going to talk about and we're not going to talk about. The first thing we're going to talk about is a definition. What is Zionism? Zionism means a lot of things to a lot of people. Any thoughts on that? Yep.
the national homeland for the Jewish people.
The national homeland, okay.
The land of Israel.
National homeland. What else is it? What does it represent? Anyone else?
Movement
for religious freedom. There's certainly something called religious Zionism, which we're going to talk about. It's always interesting. It depends on who, as the Talmud would say, it depends on whose ox you're goring. The people who say it's a religious movement sometimes want to restrict the actions of others. So it's kind of a paradox.
Zionism, I think, is an expression of the Jews' desire for either a homeland or the land.
The land. So when we say Zion or Zionism, you understand it to mean one place.
Yes.
Ancient Israel, the land of Israel, Eretz Israel, whatever you want to call it. And we're going to learn, by the way, that throughout history there were many efforts made to have a Jewish homeland somewhere else, with marginal to no success whatsoever. But there were some substantial efforts by various countries to do that. All right, so one of the interesting things that we have to deal with, too, is Zionism religious or secular? Any thoughts on that? It can be both, okay, but can it be mutually exclusive?
Religious and secular.
Certainly.
You mean be one but not the other.
Correct.
Well, I mean, there is a sect of Jews who are very anti-Israel because the Messiah didn't...
The Naturi Karta, we're going to learn about them, actually. It's a Hasidic group. They form the religious council, the Eidat Haredi of Haredim, or ultra-Orthodox, ultra-pious, however you want to translate it, Jews. Very good. Here's the interesting one. I think they're all interesting, but here's the really interesting one. Is Zionism a logical continuation of Jewish history, or is it a break from Jewish history? Is it a logical continuation, or is it something new and different and radical in Jewish history?
The origin back to the Torah in terms of the notion that there was a covenant or a gift or a grant of land, but certainly it morphs over time, and the desire for a state came about through factors that were more recent.
We're going to challenge that assumption in this course. There were other Jewish states, of course, in the land of Israel throughout history. At least one or two of them we're going to get to tonight. But I'm going to ask some other people to chime in on that as well.
Next year in Jerusalem,
at the end of the Passover Seder, the Shana Baba Yerushalayim. So you're telling me it's a continuation.
Continuation,
okay.
You know, one thing that I read that's troubling is that all Muslims are supposed to go at least make a pilgrimage one time to Mecca.
Right, the Hajj, it's called.
That's like next year in Jerusalem for us. Are they citizens of Saudi Arabia as a consequence?
No.
It kind of deflates that Hashanah, Habab, and Shalim.
In what way? Talk about that for a moment.
I mean, I think the author, this is one of the books that you get assigned to us, is saying that the desire for Muslims to go to make the Hajj to Mecca doesn't make them citizens of Saudi Arabia. Therefore, just because Jews say we should go to Israel next year doesn't make Jews citizens of Israel.
But of course, if they do go to Israel, then they get instant citizenship if they can prove that they're Jewish.
Right. If they choose.
If they choose,
a lot of Jews,
right.
Obviously, us. We
right.
go to Israel,
and,
but we're not citizens there.
Right. And the Hajj, of course, is something that you only need to do in Islam once in your life, and then you.
We don't specify.
Right, we say each year, next year in Jerusalem. But that, you know,
that's
something...
That's a religious requirement. That's a religious
right.
requirement or a religious suggestion.
The Hajj is one of the five...
Pillars of Islam.
Pillars of Islam.
Right.
So that's...
Well, one of the things that we're going to talk about, and it's one of the underlying foundational concepts, is L'shana Haba B'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, is actually messianic. Right? Go to Jerusalem because the Messiah is going to be there, and from there the Messiah is going to spread... You know, the goodness of humanity, and ostensibly the Jews will be left alone where they can study and learn all day. So it is Jewish, and it's also messianic. And there's a strain of messianism that runs throughout the Jewish belief in the state or the land of Israel, whichever one you want to call it. And there are actually at different times they mean different things, but the messianic concept underlying it all is that that's the place where it's going to happen, right? It's not just that it's Israel, it's not just that it's Jerusalem, it's that it's the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, that one hill there. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight as well. So, what impact has not the state of Israel, but the concept of Israel made in Jewish thought and history? Talk a little bit about that and give me some examples. We just did one next year in Jerusalem. Oop, got a latecomer. Any thoughts on that? What impact has the concept of Jews being entitled to the land of Israel made on Jewish thought and Jewish history? No one? Exactly. Excellent. We faced east wherever we are. So, if we're in the west. Yeah. We're in China, we face west. That's right. But we always face Jerusalem. And we always face the Temple Mount. So, absolutely. So, there's been a land focus throughout Jewish history. Any other examples? And we're going to get to some tonight.
There's always been a Jewish presence throughout the ages in Israel.
There's always been a Jewish presence throughout the ages in Israel. It's gotten very, very small at certain points. But there has always been a Jewish presence, not just in... At one point, there were no Jews in Jerusalem because the Crusaders wouldn't allow it, right? So they had Jewish communities in Akko and Sfat, for example. Yeah?
The return from Babylonia.
Return, and we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight, the return from Babylonia, which was extremely significant for our story. And that's really what we're looking at here, is a grand story with many, many chapters and many, many actors. Good evening. Welcome. Good. Can we just get your name and a little bit?
I'm Bill Horowitz.
And what do you want from this course? We all had to go through that suffering.
Beg your pardon? I just had good experiences at Towson. I took Valerie Towers' class in Holocaust.
Oh, terrific. She's great. Yeah.
Yeah, so as soon as I heard it was Towson, I just signed up.
That's music to our ears. Thank you. All right, before I go on, I realize I didn't go through the syllabus, which I promised you that we were going to do. And this is going to hopefully give you some understanding of the depth of what we're going into. And as we do this, take a look and think about things that you think might not be there, and hopefully I'll be able to say, actually, we're going to cover that in such and such a unit. All right, first of all, as you know, this course has, I believe it's 8 books. Right? Nobody's going to hold a gun to your head if you don't read the books. You'll understand a little more if you do read the books. Some of the books are really good. They're really some of the best ones out there. They're serious books for serious subjects. I can tell you the 2 books in particular by Anita Shapira and David Engels are wonderful overviews of Zionism. If you've had a chance to read that yet, you'll know exactly what I mean. Now, so these books obviously go past 1948, those 2 in particular, as does the Documents book. I encourage you to read on, you know, beyond that. But for our purposes, we're not going to get into that in here. All right, tonight we're talking about an introduction to the Zionist idea. We're going to talk a little bit about what Zion means to non-Jews, you know, why it's a lasting idea on the world stage. In biblical ancient Jewish nationalism, / Zionism, we're going to use the words nationalism and Zionism interchangeably. Just like you're going to see, we're going to use the words Jerusalem and Zion interchangeably, because that's what the text does. And when I say the text, I'm talking about the Torah or Tanakh, ancient Hebrew writings. Then we're going to go into the next week, Jewish nationalism in the Second Temple and rabbinic eras. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you mentioned Ntori Karta before, the anti-Zionist group. They hinge everything on this from the Talmud, Ketubot 111a. There's about 3 sentences in there they get their entire philosophy from. And we're going to talk a little bit about medieval Zionism. See, I told you there's a lot more to it than you thought. Then on October 29th, we're going to talk a little bit about Zionism in the context of modern nationalism. Why is it that Zionism arose when it arose? And what else was out there that was pulling the Jews? We have here what I call the other isms, communism, socialism, territorialism. There's also something called autonomism. Those were all significant movements. And by the way, you understand, when you study things like this, that you know we still feel the impact of the Holocaust, because the Holocaust wiped out all of those other isms. They wiped out all the adherents of those isms. The only one that was able to survive from European Jewry's base was Zionism, because it had already established a footprint outside of Europe. But that unfortunately is an underlying theme when you study modern Jewish history. We're also going to talk about alternative Zions, which I mentioned a few moments ago. We're going to talk about a Jewish effort, an effort to create a Jewish homeland in the deep recesses of eastern Russia, one place outside of Buffalo in 19th century, and a couple other places as well. Zimbabwe, that was one of them. Argentina was another one. El Arish was another one. It goes on and on. It wasn't just one place. Madagascar, actually. I bet the movie that my kids love would have been changed were that the case. Anyway, we're going to talk a little about early modern Zionists, the Vilna Gaon, the great Talmudic sage. A couple others are on there. Then November 12th, Russian Zionism, which was very different than Central European Zionism, plants its roots. And Russian Zionism came first. Then, of course, we're going to get to the great one of the Zionist story, Theodor Herzl. We're also going to talk about Max Nordau. Nordau pretty much lived in Herzl's shadow, but Nordau was famous first, and he was quite a substantial European intellectual who actually gave the modern Zionist movement a sense of credibility. Then we'll talk about the age of Chaim Weizmann. Then on December 10th, cultural Zionism. Echad Ha'am, who I mentioned before, he's known as the agnostic rabbi. Fascinating, fascinating figure. December 17th, the origins of labor Zionism. That'll be circa 1905, 1907, somewhere around there. Then on the 7th, we're going to get to the other legend, David Ben-Gurion, the old man, as he was always known as, it seems like, and the second Aliyah, which was the group of people that came and really got things rolling in the land of Israel or Palestine at that point. January 14th, constructive Zionism, how they actually built the framework of a state. And then constructive Zionism too, the creation of a new Hebrew culture. That's another underlying fascinating story here. Is there, you know, and there were big fights over this, which we'll talk about, as to whether or not it was going to be Hebrew or German or Yiddish or other language. Of course, when Herzl wrote Old New Land, which you have in there, he didn't talk about the language situation that much, but Hebrew certainly wasn't going to be the language of the land in the land of Israel. It was basically going to be whatever language you came from, which who knows how that would work. I think I had heard at one point that this was 20 years ago, that the people in Israel spoke 85 different languages, right? Because they came from all over the world. I used to have a friend there, lost touch with him. His mother was from Afghanistan. You know, I don't know what language she spoke, but it certainly wasn't English. We're going to do gender in labor Zionism. You have a book called The Plow Women series. We're going to take a look at the role of women and how Zionism tried to reinterpret the role of women at a time when that wasn't so much the case throughout the world. February 4th, religious Zionism. That's one of my favorite lectures. I'm absolutely fascinated by Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. And then his son went on to become a significant figure as well, Tzvi Yehuda Cook. February 11th, American Zionism. The American role in the Zionist story is very significant. They came a little late in some regards, but it's very significant. And then February 18th, binationalism. There was a significant intellectual push in pre-state Israel in Palestine to have a binational state, a state where Hebrew and Arabic would be equal and Jews and Arabs would be equal. Now, of course, this was done at a time when Jews were a minority still in the state of Israel. But that comes from the philosophy of people like Martin Buber, who you might have heard of, Gershom Scholem, Judah Magnus. Then we're going to talk about Palestinian Arab nationalism and Zionist responses. Palestinian Arab nationalism, there were some efforts at reconciliation, I want to tell you. Not many, but there were some, and we're going to focus on them. Then we'll do militant Zionism, Zev Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was really the radical, the right wing. That's where today's Likud party has its roots, in his philosophy and writings. And Menachem Begin knew Jabotinsky and was deeply influenced by him. And then the Yishuv, which is this pre-state community, during and after World War II. There were significant questions as to whether or not the Yishuv should cooperate with the British because it was fighting the Nazis, or whether or not that the Jews should fight the British and continue to bring illegal immigrants. And truth is, they wound up doing both. And they fought the British militarily as well at times. Then finally, we're going to do Palestinian and American Jewry leading up to Israel's independence. And that's where our friend Menachem Begin comes in. And then, if it snows, we're going to have a makeup class. Yes, ma'am.
I believe we're changing March
Oh, that's correct. We're going to change that. Okay. Yeah, because March 18th is a break. Thank you, Michelle. All right, that's a lot of stuff. It's really a lot of stuff. But, of course, you have 8 books to read, so you know there's a lot going on in there. Is there anything that you think you'd like to learn about, and you can certainly tell us along the way, that I didn't cover in that very loose outline? No? It's plenty, right?
And also, we don't know what we don't know.
Well, you may say, for example, I'd like to learn about Golda Meir. I want to make sure we learn about her. Well, we're going to learn about Golda Meir, the former Milwaukee Hebrew school teacher, or school teacher. All right. Ready to go on? I like to take deep breaths every now and then. Yeah, okay. Zionism has been described as the most successful of the 20th century nationalisms. If the 20th century was anything, it was a time of state creation. But Zionism really did something different than anything else because it created something where there was nothing. There was only a dream, a reaching back in history, a hope, while the world was swirling all around it. What did Zionism achieve? All right, let's take a quick look. They took a minority population to a foreign land. They recreated a language. Unlike, for example, the French Revolution, they didn't take over existing institutions. They didn't say, okay, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is now ours. They didn't say, okay, we now have a bank. They had to create banks. They had to, you know, after 1948, they had to pave roads. The British did them a tremendous favor, by the way. The British civilized Palestine more than anything else. Right, they put in roads, they put in dams, they put in hydroelectric plants. It's something that doesn't get a lot of credit. This was all done in 66 years, which was remarkable. And it really was only done in 30 years, really from when the British showed up in 1917, when Lord Allenby crossed into Jerusalem, to 1948. And it's 31 years, a very short time. One of the things that Zionism sought to do was to answer what's known as the Jewish question. Anybody know what the Jewish question is? Famous in European history. Any thoughts?
What do we do with
them? What do we do with the Jews? This was a question that intellectuals debated in Europe for about 100 years. So Zionism came along and said, we're tired of other people talking about us. We're going to take care of it on our own. We're going to set up a state, and all the European Jews are going to go there, and the ones who don't go there are going to assimilate out. Didn't quite happen that way, but there were other things that intervened. As I mentioned, Jews were busy with other nationalisms as well at this time. There was something called autonomism. There's a famous Jewish historian named Simon Dubnow, who lived in the late 19th, early 20th century, was killed by the Nazis, unfortunately, in Riga in 1941. Autonomism said that Jews in Eastern Europe were always concentrated in certain lands, or certain areas. So, for example, the Pale of Settlement was one. You might have heard of it. Galiciana Yiddish comes from there and all that. He had said, no, what we need to do is we need to make that area a separate autonomous state, that it'll still report to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, just like the Czechs have their separate state, and other minorities, such as in what became Yugoslavia, have their separate state. It's all autonomous, an autonomous region within. That was wiped out too, of course. There was someone named Israel Zangwill who promoted something called territorialism. Israel Zangwill said, no, we need full independent states. So, for example, and we need to get Jews out of Europe. That was the first thing that everybody decided. Well, not everybody. The autonomists didn't. The territorialists and the Zionists agreed. We need to get the Jews out of Europe. Anti-Semitism is getting worse. Anti-Semitism begins to get worse in the 1870s and 1880s in Europe. There are anti-Semitic political parties in France and Germany in particular. And the ones in Germany laid the roots for the Holocaust in every regard, actually. So territorialism said we need to take Jews and put them in Argentina, we need to put them in Madagascar. They even did something called the Galveston Plan. Galveston, Texas, they brought 9,000 Jews from Eastern Europe into this country through Galveston. And they wanted them to settle in a certain area, but they went up through the towns, small towns in Texas. Even today, you can find some people who trace their roots to the Galveston Plan. The only ism that Jews were against was monarchism. Why? Well, no, not because we have a king. You know, a lot of these Jews were secularists. They were against the monarchy because the monarchy, you know, kicked their butt wherever they were, right? The monarchy, the Jews could never gain a leg up in a monarchy. If they had autonomism, they would have some sense of self-rule. There was no self-rule to be adherent to a monarch. But that was the only ism that they were against of the era. All right, let's moving on. When did Zionism begin? Any thoughts on that?
What form?
Any form that you care to answer.
It's possible that it started when...
When we left Egypt. Which time? Okay, when we left Egypt.
Moses took us out of Egypt.
Okay.
After the fall of the first temple.
After the fall of the first temple, 586. Excellent. All right, those are any other answers? Okay. The desire for the Jews to come home to the homeland indeed started after the fall of the first temple, and we're going to see that in a little bit of text this evening. It intensified after the great revolt against Rome in 132 to 135 CE. Jews in the dispersal throughout the Roman Empire followed. That was the Bar Kokhba revolution. The great revolt, I'm sorry, was 67 to 70. Zionism, or the belief that the Jews belong in the land of Israel, the belief that the Jews have a stake in the land of Israel, the belief that the Jews own the land of Israel because it was a gift to God, and the whole purpose of Jewish history is to get back there, really started back then. Right? You didn't have to be a Zionist until 586 because you didn't get kicked out of the land until then. So that's really when it began. It would take on mystical meaning for Jews through false messiahs and people who study Kabbalah, Kabbalists. It was always about getting back to Jerusalem. And there was a heavenly Jerusalem and there was an earthly Jerusalem. And the earthly Jerusalem was usually in pretty bad shape. All right. Moments ago, I asked if Zionism was radical or conservative. We talked about that. So the question becomes... And I think, what did we decide on that?
You said secular or religious.
Secular religious. And indeed, that's a great paradox, right? The people who had always hoped for the land of Israel were religious, right? Throughout the ages, because there was no such thing as a secular Jew. It wasn't until the secular era, however, the modern era, the emancipation era, that secular Jews were the ones who really began to make it happen. Then the religious Zionists slowly crept in. Not all Jews, by the way, then and now, are Zionists. Right? Anybody familiar with, this is just an aside, the classical reform approach to Zionism? Anybody familiar with that? Well, today the reform movement is staunchly Zionist, like all mainstream movements. The classical reform Judaism, which really, I'd say, until the 1960s was substantial, even the 70s in certain congregations in this country and certainly overseas, basically said that the Jews needed to be everywhere. We don't need to go back to a land of Israel. First of all, it's a bad thing to have all the Jews concentrated in one place. Right? There's a... I can't remember which book I read. Oh, it was Philip Roth's book, Operation Shylock. Anybody ever read that?
Okay, I don't remember it.
Okay. So one of the things in that book is that the false Philip Roth, who was running around the world, wants to get all the Jews out of Israel because he's afraid that they're a target for an atomic bomb. He said, if Zionism succeeds, we'll destroy the Jewish people. And that's indeed what classical reform argued for decades, if not a century or so.
Excuse me, this is Rabbi Agus.
Was Rabbi Agus of that ilk?
Absolutely opposed to everyone being in one place to be annihilated.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, of course, is that all the Jews were never in one place. I mean, it's interesting.
He was opposed to that.
But I'm guessing that he wasn't anti-Zionist. He just didn't want everybody to be there.
No.
Yeah, I didn't know Rabbi Agus, so. Yeah, and an appropriate comment in the Agus Library. All right. Jewish socialists, of course, and we're going to talk about them later in the course, too. There's communists. They didn't want Jews to be in the land of Israel. Right, they wanted the equal societies, redistribution of wealth, and the great paradox, of course, by the way, is the Jewish communists in the new Soviet Union they had a whole division called Yevsexia, which was their propaganda arm that was aimed toward the Jews, and they published everything and did all their work in Yiddish. And you know, that's a great paradox, because that's the most inherently Jewish language you can come up with in the modern world, or certainly in Europe. All right. Any questions until now? Let's see how we're doing. Oh, we're doing great. Okay. Different faces of Zionism. What Zionism means to others. We'll start with Christianity. I want you to understand that, you know, Jews are, there are currently about 14 million Jews in the world. But the concept of Zion and Zionism is substantial to the monotheistic religions in the world today. Zion appears 7 times in the New Testament. 5 are quotes from the Hebrew Bible, right? Because it's really a continuation of the Hebrew Bible, or the Torah. In the New Testament, the daughter of Zion is the bride of Jesus. I have to look at my notes entirely on the Christian stuff, sorry. It's just not as good on that. The daughter of Zion is the bride of Jesus, which is the church. Right? It's a synonym for the church. The meaning of God's spiritual kingdom is the heavenly Jerusalem. And Judaism has a heavenly Jerusalem, too. Peter refers to Jesus as the cornerstone of Zion. He says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. So keep all your faith in me." It's frequently, Zion is, comes up frequently in Christian literature and hymns. It's a designation for the heavenly city, or for, even for the earthly city. And it's really an understanding that this is the land where Jesus walked. That's basically what it's saying, is that Jesus, it's an appropriation of that. Zionism as the is the New Jerusalem, by the way, is not just a New Testament notion. Ezekiel 40-48 speaks of the New Jerusalem with a detailed description of the temple that has 12 gates. Why would the temple have 12 gates? 12 tribes, that's right. 12 is one of those mystical numbers in Judaism. Zechariah expands on that. He talks about a city wall of fire to protect the enormous population. So when you get into the prophets, you know, we usually on Shabbat when we follow along or whatever, we don't really kind of read the English and say, what is this, you know, whacked out visions that they're getting into? And they're pretty substantial. Isaiah has the New Jerusalem adorned with sapphires, jewels, and rubies, and is a city free from terror and full of righteousness. Again, messianic in its approach. Book of Revelation. Anybody ever read the Book of Revelation? I've read it before. It's pretty wild. That's the end of the world one. One day I sat down and read the New Testament. That's pretty interesting. The last two chapters deals with the vision of the New Jerusalem. That's what the whole thing is about. And it's got serpents with multi-heads and all this coming in. There's a John of Patmos who describes the New Jerusalem as the bride, the wife of the Lamb, which is obviously Jesus. An angel takes him to a vantage point on a great and high mountain to see the New Jerusalem's descent. So they see Jerusalem as coming down from the heavens. And there's, of course, a famous midrash of, oh no, that's of Mount Sinai hovering above the Jewish people. There's an elaborate description of New Jerusalem as its Garden of Eden-like. It has rivers and a wall and a tree of life, but there's no temple. Right? They never describe it as having a temple. Why wouldn't they have a temple? Exactly. That's exactly right. That's because it's Jewish. A tree of life grows in the middle of the street. A tree of life. Where have we heard that before? It bears 12 kinds of fruits, and it bears every month. In American folklore, also, the concept of Zion has been substantial. Anyone familiar with Robert Lowry? He was a mid-19th century writer. He wrote popular hymns. Yeah, you've probably heard this, Marching to Zion. We're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. We're marching upward to Zion. This was sung in the churches throughout the country. The beautiful city of God. The hill of Zion yields 1,000 sacred sweets before we reach the heavenly fields, before we reach the heavenly fields, or walk the golden streets. And then in the Civil War, very interesting, both sides appropriated Zion in this country. American slaves longing for freedom sang about Zion and spoke of Zion, freedom from Babylon. The Southern soldiers appropriated the concept of Zion too. Reverend William Hauser, chaplain of the 48th Company in Georgia, wrote, "Every night the holy songs of Zion go up on this balmy spring air, a sweet incense, incense, I think, to the throne of the eternal. So he was writing about a camp. Right, today there's Christian Zionism. Anybody familiar with Christian Zionism?
In Utah, most of the Church of Latter-day Saints have Zion as a part of theirs.
Right.
Actually, I flew down to Tangier Island in the southern Chesapeake Bay,
mm-hmm.
and there are flags of Israel.
Yeah, a lot of churches.
I was amazed.
I was in Boonesville, Maryland, about 2 months ago on a Sunday. We went up to Antietam to see it for the day, and we passed some small little church, and they had the church flag, the American flag, and the flag of Israel. Yeah.
Hard to believe.
It's amazing. Anybody else know anything about Christian Zionism?
Well, that's among some evangelicals, the notion that Israel can control the Jews is a prelude to the second coming.
Right. Well, most Christian Zionists, and I've been to some of their conventions, and I used to do a lot of writing on them. Most Christian Zionists will tell you, sooner or later, all the Jews are going to wind up back in Israel, and Jesus is going to come back, and God's going to convert the ones that aren't killed in the great battles or whatever. But that's for God to work out. I'm not going to worry about that. What I know now is I need to protect the state of Israel. So they learn to dance that theological dance. It's very interesting when you talk to them about it.
The Mormons
do have, they have a seminary on the Mount of Olives. And to get it, they had to sign an agreement with the State of Israel that they wouldn't proselytize. And, that's kind of like telling Jews not to eat on Pesach, right? I mean, that's not going to happen. Did you want to say something? Okay. Christian Zionism overlaps with some secular Zionism in that, and we're going to see, in the British government in the early 1900s, there were many Christian Zionists, including Lord Balfour of the famous Balfour Declaration. And that was a strain that ran through the parliament there. So a number of British lawmakers in the early 20th century. It's a Protestant belief. Yeah? Nope.
Is there anything in the Quran that acknowledges a special relationship between Jews and any territory associated with
We're going to get to that, and tell me if I don't answer your question. But we're going to get to the Islam next. It's a Protestant belief. It's primarily evangelical. It's not Catholic. Catholics are not, there's no Catholic Zionist group. There is something called Christians United for Israel, which is an evangelical group. It's Pastor Hagee. John Hagee is his first name. They believe in what's called dispensations or time periods. They believe we're in the dispensation of grace right now. And a dispensation has no particular amount of time. The only thing that has a particular amount of time is when Jesus comes back for them, there's going to be he's going to have a 1,000-year rule. I don't know if anyone's ever asked what happens after that 1,000 years. We know that history kind of goes on, as Jewish history tells us. They base their views on did you want to say something? They base their views on Genesis 12:3. Which we just read this past Shabbat, and I was flipping through, and I said, oh yeah, I'm going to be talking about that. It says, God says to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Every Christian evangelical Zionist that I've ever spoken to says, I do it because of Genesis 12:3. They take the text absolutely literally, and that's all there is to it. They do have commentary, but it's a little different than our process. They closely read the apocalyptic books like the book of Daniel and some other prophets. There is a big fight in the Christian world over Zionism between what are called the mainstream or mainline Protestants and the evangelical Protestants. Right? The Christian world is divided basically into Catholics and Protestants. That's it. And there's a whole bunch of denominations under Protestants. There's only one Catholic group. And they answer to the Pope, obviously. There are no secular dimensions whatsoever to their belief in the Christian Zionists, to their belief in the State of Israel. No secular dimensions whatsoever. Unlike many Jews who we'll see in this country, last century, and I would say even today, say, I'm not a religious Jew, but I'm a Zionist. I believe in the State of Israel. I believe that there needs to be a state for the Jewish people. I've been to the Christians United for Israel convention a couple times, and it's pretty wild, to say the least. It's kind of like being in a big New Year's bash without booze. there's a lot of singing. There's like a 40-piece orchestra. There's 5,000 people crammed into a hall at the Washington Convention Center. Benjamin Netanyahu gave them a satellite address one day. I was there. And, you know, Pastor Hagee, he's from some town in Texas, and, you know, it's like a rock concert. He's, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu! And, you know, they go crazy. Everybody gets up, screaming, hooting. You know, I mean, it's, you know, for Bibi, it was the greatest crowd he could ever imagine. He wishes the Jews would treat him like that. It's a pretty wild experience. If you ever have the opportunity, go to it. Ironically, by the way, Christians United for Israel has a Jew as its executive director, a guy named David Brog, who's from an observant Christian, observant conservative Jewish home. I don't know how observant he is now, but he was Arlen Specter's chief of staff for a while, and I've met him and interviewed him before. And, you know, he just says, hey, Jews don't get it. These are our best friends, you know? Yeah, a lot of people feel that way.
You see them at AIPAC also.
Oh, absolutely.
And they came and spoke it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was a very crazy presentation.
Yeah, what was it like?
Alternative University.
Yeah.
They brought a lot of people from their church, and there were some Jews and Christians. The guy that gave this, it was like a real fire and brimstone. Like he had flames coming out on his presentation.
Right.
PowerPoint. But John Hagee, and this is town of Ariel, which is in Samaria, was built by John Hagee. He grew there in the disputed territories. You really see everything has his name on it, and it's really just kind of...
Yeah, they raise substantial money. Substantial money. And when they go to Israel, they, you know, they have a Sukkot rally in Jerusalem each year where they march through the streets because the Feast of Tabernacles is a big deal to them. The point is... Yep?
I'll say if you compare the number of Christians go to Israel versus the number of Jews. Christians overwhelm the number of Jews that go. And they go when it counts, such as rocket attacks and things like that.
Yeah, they don't cancel trips.
Right, like we do.
Right.
Well, there are 50 million of them.
Yeah, the critical mass comes into play.
They go.
And no question. There's a group called Sorel where you can volunteer.
The Volunteers for Israel, it's called in English.
And when you go on those kinds of trips, usually more than half of the people who are serving on army bases are non-Jews. And they will say very simply, "Is God gave this land to you all, to the Jews, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that you never lose it." I mean, they're right out front with it. They don't make any bones about it.
All right.
But a lot of this goes back to the 19th century. In Michael Oren's book on U.S.
Right, I've read that book, yeah. John Nelson Darby.
Yeah, and it talks about all the people that tried to develop settlements in Israel that failed, as a matter of fact.
Right. There were some in Haifa and Jerusalem. Right, absolutely. No, it's the point that I'm trying to make is that Zionism and Zion is not just a Jewish concept. Right? It's something that has resonance throughout the rest of the monotheistic world. Now, I don't really think that it means too much in China, but it does mean something wherever there is Islam or Christianity. So if we're not paying attention, surely others are. And that's worth knowing as well as we go forward. And as you'd mentioned, I have a note in here, many churches have Zion in their name. St. Timothy's, that would be a Catholic one. I don't know what the titles would be. But there's even I just wanted to mention one more thing, Zion Oil and Gas Company. It was founded to create oil in Israel or off the shore of Israel. And it's run by an evangelical guy. And the reason being is that he wants the state of Israel to be independent from the Arab oil that controls the world, so on and so on and so on.
Just to throw in one more religion, the Rastafarians also adhere. Haile Selassie was the Lion of Judah.
Of Ethiopia, you're right, right.
And also they sing a lot about Zion, like Bob Marley.
Right, we're gonna get to that, actually. Marcus Garvey, who was a black nationalist, was inspired by Zionism. All right, Islam. Here we wanted to mention Islam. The Quran does not mention Zion. Right, the Quran is the holy book. It does not mention Zion. Jerusalem is important in Islam. You know, that's where Muhammad's horse touched down, according to the legend, on its way to the heavens, and that was on the Temple Mount. It all goes back to the Temple Mount. There was his night flight to the heavens. Then that spot was important, of course, because that's where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac. That's where King David bought the land from Aruna the Hittite. Early Islamic rule called Jerusalem Medinat Bat al-Maqdis, or the City of God's Temple. So we know that there was some respect there for the fact that there was a Jewish temple there. Now it's called Al-Quds al-Sharif, or the Noble City. That's one way to say it. Jerusalem is considered the third holy city in Islam, right? Mecca and Medina are before that. But it's Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem.
But has it always been considered a holy city?
Yes, because Muhammad's horse touched there. Yes, for that reason alone.
They never went there.
Correct.
They never had a government there. And they never,
correct.
You know, through all
the absolutely. Time. They didn't have a Jesus there like the Christians did. Absolutely. That's their reasoning. And it's not the most important city. Right? I assume that almost anywhere that Muhammad would have stepped would be considered holy to them. Just as, you know, if we knew where Moses stepped, it would be considered holy to us. So, but I understand your point. Jerusalem itself is not mentioned. Right? Zion's not mentioned, and Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran. Islamic scholars will tell you there are allusions to it. Right? And this is, Jewish scholars do this too in terms of our own text. We say what that really refers to is such and such. Muhammad originally prayed toward Jerusalem. What's thought that happened is that the Jews of Saudi Arabia, of the Saudi plain, it wasn't called Saudi Arabia then, just Arabia, I guess, rejected Muhammad. Right? As the story goes, Muhammad went to them and said he's the Messiah, and so on and so on. And they said, okay, read the Torah for us, and Muhammad was illiterate. He couldn't read the Torah. So they said, forget it, you're not. So of course, you know, later he went and had his people went and slaughtered them. But it is said that when the Jews rejected Muhammad, that Muhammad began praying toward Mecca. So that's where that comes in. Zion in Arabic is Sakhyun, and the Zion gate in Jerusalem is Bab Sakhyun. Bab means gate. It's also in Aramaic as well. There's something called Wadi Sakhyun, which is not far from the Jaffa Gate. And the Kaaba in Mecca, the big stone there, is called the Sakhyun, or also the Zion. Or not Zion, Zion. All right, so does that answer your question about the Islam? Does that dig into it a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. Oh, you can tell me if not. I can find out some more. All right.
Well, he didn't anticipate Muhammad, I mean, as far as we know, he didn't anticipate how far the initial expansion of Islam would take, so he wasn't...
Sure, he couldn't.
Orally.
Right, he couldn't. There's no way he could have envisioned that. I mean, you know, today you have Muslims in Sri Lanka. Right, there's absolutely no way. It's actually, Islam is the most successful religion in the world in many regards.
Within a generation, right? I mean,
yeah, it was very quick. It was very quick. You know, these were Arabic nomads, basically. Absolutely. All right, the Mormons. All right, Zion refers to a specific location where members of the church are to be gathered to live. Then there's something. Anybody ever read the Book of Mormon? That's a crazy text.
I've seen the show.
Oh yeah, that's a crazy text. I hate to insult Mormons, but
especially if you ever gone.
I haven't seen the show, but it's coming to the Hippodrome.
If you go to Salt Lake City and they move you towards all the dioramas of the craziest.
The little bit that I've looked at, the stuff that's in there is wild. Absolutely.
They all have five kids. No, but they, you know, they come in and they...
One for each book of the Torah?
One can name the phone number. It's in the church.
Oh, yeah.
After that, only Mormons will...
Right, my mother went in there, too. Yeah, she said it was absolutely stunning.
The mother's alive.
Yeah, wow. Who knew? Who knew? That explains a lot. All right. They talk about an ancient city of Enoch, which is also named Zion, that was taken to heaven and will return to earth. So the Mormons believe that the city of Jerusalem or Zion was lifted up and one day will come back. And a temple will be built to God for a sacred work and for Jesus to reign from when he returns. They also believe Zion is a location of their congregations, wherever they're at, is Zion, basically, because that's a holy, sacred place. They are mixed on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Some of their scholars have been pretty anti-Israel. Some of them have been pretty, you know, neutral. I wouldn't say any of them, from what I understand, has been rabidly pro-Israel, although there's a definitional issue there that we'd have to get into as well. Officially, their church won't take sides. Right? They say, and that's smart, because they now have this beautiful seminary on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, and Jews are afraid that they're going to proselytize, which my understanding is they have indeed done that. But they always had a relationship with Zion. It goes back to 1840. Joseph Smith, their founder, sent a guy named Orson Hyde to Jerusalem, and in Hyde said he dedicated the land, and he prayed for, quote, the gathering together of Judah's sacred remnants. Then in 1921, Herbert Grant, the president of the Mormon General Conference, said, apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ have been to the Holy Land and have dedicated that country for the return of the Jews, and we believe that in due time of the Lord they shall be in the favor of God again, and let no Latter-day Saint be guilty of taking any part in any crusade against these people. So I guess that's kind of a nice way of his saying you're not supposed to bother the Jews too much, right? All right, there's one more. We're going to go before the break. Black nationalism was actually inspired by Zionism in this country. The Zionist success in winning the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which was the British government's agreement for a Jewish homeland, not a Jewish state, but a Jewish homeland, in the land of Palestine, inspired a black nationalist named Marcus Garvey. He's a very famous figure in that community. He formed a movement to bring black Americans back to Africa. And he, in a 1920 speech in Harlem, he said, other races were engaged in seeing their cause through, the Jews through their Zionist movement and the Irish through their Irish movement, and I decided that cost what it might, I would make this a favorable time to see the Negroes' interests through. Well, his movement didn't get anywhere, but it inspired the Rastafarians, as I think Mitch mentioned a few moments ago. Black Jews, African Hebrew Israelites of Jerusalem. Those are now the black Hebrews who live in Dimona in Israel. Originally, they went to Jerusalem.
They were the Chicago people.
They were in Chicago, yeah.
But they're not accepted by anybody.
Correct. They were in Chicago, and there's still a group of them in South Florida. Ben-Ami Carter, I think, was their head guy. All right, we're going to take a break, but just to recap, what we've done is we've talked about concepts of Zion and what it means, the lasting impact it's had on history, and the fact that it means something to non-Jews as well. All right, so we'll take a quick break. And Jill has snacks.
Ooh.